Danny, what about this?
Burn, this is extremely difficult. This is one of the toughest pitches on the entire play.
Here it comes.
Oh, my goodness. In your life have you seen anything like that?
Welcome to the first episode of Talking Golf with me, Hugh Moore. For many of us, the US Masters at Augusta represents the start of the golfing year. What better way to launch our show than by celebrating everything Augusta and the Masters with Paul Casey? Paul recently won the Valspar Championship and PGA Tour, which lifts him to 13th in the world and 10th in the FedEx Cup ranking. Paul, welcome. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure, mate.
It's nice to hear you.
I know, I'm a long way away, but yeah, loud and clear.
So loud and clear.
Exciting. Very exciting.
Well, you're the first guest on the podcast, and as you know, we're celebrating all things US Masters in Augusta. I want to take you back to 2004, which was your debut year, and you're making that drive up Magnolia for the very first time. Tell us a little bit about your first impressions, how the place grabbed you, what are the things you remember most from the first year there?
The first thing I remember was about a month before. I took a recce to Augusta about a month before, having never played it, knowing that I was in it. As a competitor, you're allowed to play. You're allowed to turn up. I'm not sure if they changed the rules, because actually I tend not to go back early now because I know the course so well, but I went early to just, I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
You're in the Masters. You get to play Augusta National, touted as, you know, one of the best golf courses, if not the best golf course on the world. So, you know, flew in, stayed at a very average hotel, and ended up getting... So the drive down Magnolia Lane, I mean, first of all, you've been there.
Yeah.
And anybody who hasn't been there, it's, you know, just a sort of... you would miss it driving past the front gate.
Oh, you really would.
Just
hidden away
right
in the corner.
If you're not paying attention. Yeah, just big bushes, big sort of bamboo and green bushes. Small little guardhouse. I think he's still there, and I should know his name. I feel it's kind of sacrilegious that I don't know this the security guard's name, because he's the same guy who's been there for forever. And he kind of gives you the look, and he gave me the look, sort of, what are you doing? And I give him my name, and he goes down the clipboard, and you just, it's that moment of, you think you're never going to get in. It's like standing in front of a nightclub, and your name's not on the list as a kid, and you're just like, this is going to go really badly. And he sort of, but he let me in. And he goes, just follow it down, sir, and take a ride at the end. And so that's what you do. And suddenly you're on your own driving down Magnolia, and it's the coolest driveway in golf. It's one of the coolest driveways in the world, but it's the coolest driveway in golf. 300 yards long, roughly, and it opens out, and you get to see the clubhouse and the roundabout with the flowers and the flag, and it's sort of it's like Disneyland for golfers. And it still sticks even to this day when I drive down that driveway, and I know you've driven down that driveway with me several times. It's a cool feeling.
Really is.
Not many events, there's not many golf courses, not many events in the world where you feel special, but you feel very special and very privileged to drive down that driveway. And I love the fact there was a period when we didn't get to drive down that driveway as much. You'd have
to make
a decision to
make
the drive.
That's right. We had to drive in over the what's now the new driving range, didn't we?
Yes, correct.
Kind of 5-6 years, maybe.
Yeah, you still come through the front gate, but you'd hook a quick right and go behind the practice,
that's
the old
right,
practice ground. But now you have to drive down Magnolia, and I think that's the tradition. One of those cool things. So I love it. I still love it. They still let me in. Although you're still looking
barely.
Slightly suspiciously.
I don't think that ever goes away. You're going to be stuck with that forever.
What, the slight suspicion?
Yeah, I think
it's
so.
Just me. but going back to that first visit, again, I'm terrible at names, I really am. But Carl, is it Jackson?
Ben
Crenshaw's longtime caddy.
Correct.
His brother actually looped for me on that first ever round of golf.
Amazing.
My first ever practice round. I didn't know who he was. Very nice gentleman. off I go to the first tee. No real guidance. You feel like you're sort of left on your own. Out you go. There's nobody out there. Maybe see a member or two, and that's it. And I kind of feel like, what now? Should somebody announce me? Am I okay to play? Are there any rules? And off we went. And I just had the most joyous day and a half there. And I learned so much that very first day.
And that was just you and the caddy?
Yeah, and I credit Carl's brother. And I should really track him down. I know he's around because I learned so much. I think when you have a first, like anything, you walk into, you're buying a house. You know, people say you know within the first few seconds whether you're going to buy it or not. You see the love of your life and you instantly fall in love, and my instant impression of Augusta was, I love this place and I know I'm going to play well around here.
And thankfully that seems to have carried on over the years.
Yeah, I think it's, like I say, one, I love it. I think it also suits my game. High ball flight, I have the ability to turn it a little bit if I need to, right to left. It's funny, I don't get counted as a very good putter, and obviously the statistics back that up, but I am a very good touch putter. I may not make as many 15-footers as, the Jordan Spieths of the world, but I very rarely get too crossed up on very, very fast greens. Yeah. So when these guys are not making lots and lots of 15-footers, it actually sort of plays a little bit into my hands, because neither am I, but I roll all the sort of 15-footers very, very close.
I've got a theory about this, that certainly in modern times, as the greens have got, they're just as slopey as they've always been, but they're firmer, they're faster. I don't think you need to be an exceptional putter to do well at Augusta. And the winners over the years would tend to back that up. If you look at, last year you had Justin and Sergio, both who are renowned for being fairly ordinary putters.
Not great.
And if you look historically over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a number of guys who've struggled with a putter who've won. Bubba Watson, Adam Scott, Bubba's won twice. Sergio and Justin. I think it's a great equalizer because, as you say, the better putters, no one holds loads of 15 footers around there.
Correct. As long as you don't balls it up, as long as you don't, start racing 6 footers, 6 foot past.
Yeah.
It comes down to, you have to obviously drive it very well. You have to position yourself around that golf course and take the stress off yourself, off the rest of your game. I played with Freddie Couples last year in the first round. I played with Kevin Na and Freddie Couples in the first two rounds. Kevin's a very good player, but Kevin was, hitting it well, but maybe, I don't say too aggressive, but he was going for stuff and started getting on the wrong side of things. And Freddie was wonderful. Freddie was just sort of loping around the golf course as he does, absorbing the atmosphere. People love him, as they should, because he's a rock star. He hit a drive right next to mine on the first hole, first round of the week. The pin's back right, and he hits an awful shot. He hits one of the worst second shots I've ever seen on number one. But he misses it, middle of the green length, way left, over towards the sort of ninth tee. But he's missed it in a spot where he had a very, very easy chip up the green. Yes, he had a beautiful chip, but he tipped it up to 3 feet. I mean, it's pretty easy to chip it within 10 feet. Meanwhile, Kevin Na, somewhere else on the right-hand side, making bogey, just proceeded to play that kind of round of golf when the pin was front right on 10. Guess where Freddie missed it? He missed it high left.
Yeah.
Missed the green beautifully and chipped up to a foot and cruised around in a very respectable, few under, and took the stress off the rest of the game. So my point being, if you know how to play the golf course, and all these guys who, these take Bubba Watson, Adam Scott, Sergio won last year, they know how to play it. They know where to miss it. You don't have to hit heroic shots all the time. Obviously, it helps. Just don't miss it in the wrong spot. Don't mess up with the putting. Don't run it past 6 feet all the time. And guess what? You can make a lot of birdies.
Yeah. Well, the par fives are obvious chances. And
they're all reachable, which is rare in major golf nowadays.
And good iron play can result in you hitting it very close. Mediocre iron play, generally you can two-putt it. But poor iron play, you're struggling.
But then again, I guess that poor iron play, missing it in the wrong spot, is poor iron play.
Yeah.
Good iron play is playing to the right portion of the green, and if you don't hit a good one, you still got a shot. I always think that's great architecture at Augusta, because it doesn't matter where you hit it, you've always got an opportunity.
Yeah.
And we see so many golf courses nowadays where you can the guy gets the wrong side of a hole, wrong side of a slope, and there's absolutely no way of pulling it off. So you have to chip it 20 feet the other side and struggle to make par, struggle to recover. Augusta, there's always a shot. Now, it might be incredibly difficult. It might be heroic, it might be spectacular, but there's always a shot. So there's great architecture there, and if you understand how it works and how it's laid out, you can use it to your advantage.
And there's, I mean, there's no question that the more you go back, the better you become at playing the course. I think we've had two first-time winners in history. Obviously, the very first Masters, and
Fuzzy Zeller.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course, the very first one.
The very first one.
Obvious.
Yeah.
I would have wished that one completely. yeah, that's knowledge. I played my practice rounds in the early days, and I guess not so much nowadays, but I guess because I'm older. But when I was younger, so 04 being my first, I played practice rounds with Ray Floyd, with Bernard Langer, with Crenshaw, Freddie Couples. It's all these... Fuzzy Zeller, I always used to play back nine on Wednesdays with him early in the morning.
Yeah.
I play with these guys because, one, they're really cool and they've got a ton of stories, but really I play with them because I want to glean a little bit of information. And they all had something. And
so,
it was,
so what happens when the youngsters now want to start playing with you? Are you going to be just as open and free with your advice as the old-timers were with you?
Yeah, I've got no... Because they've still got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got no issue with that because I've always felt that it's me against the golf course. Does it become, it's me against however many players are in the field this year, 80-something, 90 guys. And of course, I want to beat them all. But ultimately, that's why I love golf. It's, for the most part, it's us against the elements, against the course, against the architect. Then rarely it comes down to you one-on-one, head-to-head against the opponent.
When it does, that's when golf tournaments become truly memorable. You think back to Watson and Nicklaus at Turnberry, but more recently, Mickelson and Henrik at Troon. They stick in your mind because they were both playing great golf. They were playing a different golf course to everyone else, and they were competing directly head-to-head.
Yeah, and that's fantastic. So giving out information, which I guess could ultimately be detrimental to my success, I don't have an issue with, because, I mean, it happens pretty rarely. Others helped me, certainly at Augusta and in my career, so why not help others?
Absolutely.
I think it's the greatest thing you can do anyway. You teach. I think it's the greatest thing you can do as a human being is to help somebody else, to teach
Absolutely.
Somebody else.
Couldn't agree more. So let's carry on the sort of theme of what it takes to play well there. A lot is written about how important it is to move it right to left, which certainly has been something you've historically been very good at. High right to left ball flight suits pretty much every tee shot round there. How much of an advantage do you think it is, particularly under the gun, wherein you have a lefty being able to hit big slices versus a righty trying to hit big draws?
I would say it's a massive advantage. I can't tame it down. It's a huge advantage. Unless you're somebody naturally like a big right-to-left hitter, like Rory's his ability to hit right-to-left is pretty epic.
Yeah.
Most guys don't have that ability. It's not very easy. It's really easy, a big slice.
Yeah, particularly with modern equipment.
Every amateur can do it. I'm not seeing too many amateurs who have a controlled hook. Everybody's got a controlled slice somewhere in their bag.
Yeah.
It's huge. I've gone backwards and forwards with this. You don't need to hook it as much as for a right-to-left player, obviously. You don't need to hook it, hit it right-to-left as much as you may have used to. The tees have been moved so far back now. The course has become so long. And there's been so many trees that have been planted. That quite often though, where the hole starts to curve is now so far down from the tee box, let's say it's like 270, 280, it doesn't really matter. The ball's going to land, and if you can almost get a little bit of an accent, a hint of shape when it lands, that's what you really need.
A lot of those right-to-left those right-to-left tee shots, the fairway helps you draw it as it's coming out of the air.
Yeah.
As it's landing.
Yeah,
it's,
the only one's 14.
Yeah.
The only one's 14. 14 goes the other way. I will say this, you don't want to have a guy, a player who's predominantly hitting a left-to-right shape. My example for that would be Martin Kiner. This is a guy who hits he just can't hit a draw.
He's a hellish good fader, though.
He's a brilliant fader of the golf ball. I mean, Greg Craig, he's got two majors, a player's championship, Ryder Cup star. But he can't draw it. He can't draw it consistently. And you'd have to look at his record. He's played a lot of Masters and maybe only made a couple of cuts.
Yeah. How do we explain Nicklaus's success there? As a renowned, I guess, a push fader is probably a more accurate way to describe him, but he was certainly more capable of hitting it left to right than he was of moving the other way. Why was he so good there?
Yeah, the golf course was very different. Pre Tiger era, holes like 11, 15, 17, no trees on the right side of any of those holes back then. And now those holes are very, very claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Not trying to put it down, but it's a very different examination that is put in front of you now compared to the way it used to be.
And even since, I mean, 2004, your first year, and I was there that year with you, pretty much every hole's been lengthened. Some of them are fundamentally different holes to, as I say, were 14 years ago. It's relatively recent. You look at 7, for example, which was historically, it was a flick in there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, probably 12 and 13 would be the only two which I would say haven't significantly been increased. Maybe 10 haven't gone back that far.
And there
one used to come out of the pro shop and walk onto the first tee. Now you come out of the pro shop and you go left about 100 yards.
Well, it's the middle of the old putting green now, isn't it?
Yeah, very different. Look at my first Masters I remember watching on TV vividly was Sandy Lahr, which I believe was 87. And when he hit his 2-iron into the bunker and then flicked the 7-iron on the green, if you look at the images of where he hit his 2-iron from off the tee, he was just behind the road. Now, that road has not moved. That road is still there.
Yep.
If anybody goes back now and you watch it on TV this year, check out where the road is.
Yeah,
it's way down there.
Woozy blew it over the bunkers with driver from that tee.
That's brilliant.
Maybe he was the first true power player.
Well, you know, I could say Nicklaus was every number one, every truly great player has, you know, moved the needle up, and they've usually done it because they've driven the ball drastically different to the generation before or the players before. Nicklaus drove it incredibly long.
He was long.
He was long. And you look at, I guess maybe the exception might be Faldo. He's not a long player, but, you know, Norman was long. You look at Tiger's long, Dustin's long, Rory's long. There's going to be a generation after Dustin. You know, I play with guys like Jamie Sedlowski, the long drive, two-time long drive champion, world long drive champion. I mean, this guy's got 100 regular driver, not his game, you know, 130-something mile an hour clubhead speed and carries it 340 just for, you know, every day, just on average.
And, I mean,
there's going to be that jump.
I've been saying this for a while now, that at some point soon there's going to be a guy who shifts it at 130. And there's already a couple out here who are proper quick. The minute they learn to play the game, it becomes an entirely different game. And someone will. You can control that, put it in play with that. It's an entirely different game.
So I think, you know, I haven't watched enough of Nicklaus's victories around Augusta. I should probably go back. I believe they're all on YouTube now. Is that right? You know,
I'm sure.
No, I read somewhere it was on... Like Jeff Shackelford's blog or something that every single Masters is now on YouTube to view. And if it is, I need to get on it. Because I would hazard a guess that Nicklaus drove it in spots that gave him such a big advantage or had the ability to drive it in spots. You know, if 17, when there never used to be any trees down the right-hand side, players such as Bernard Langer would look at the pin position and then elect to either drive it down sort of what is traditionally the fairway now, pretty straight towards the green, or wing it out towards the 15th fairway because there's no trees and attack the green, you know, kind of eliminating that front bunker or creating a different angle to a back left pin, let's say, or a front right pin location.
Yeah.
And I would hazard a guess that Nicklaus probably did the same. So you talk about him not lacking the ability to hook the golf ball off the tee. And again, you don't need to back then.
No.
Play a different kind of golf course.
Yeah, very different course. There's specific skills that required that rather conveniently tend to match the way you play the game. You've stopped playing the week before majors probably 5 or 6 years ago now. Would that be a fair
That's a fair assessment, yeah.
Yeah. So you've got this week back home in Arizona. What are you doing? What does your preparation entail? Is it anything different to preparing for, I don't know, Valspar a couple of weeks ago or preparing for a British Open? Are you doing anything out of the ordinary to prepare for Augusta?
For the most part, it's predominantly the same. The reason for now taking weeks off before is really just an energy thing, trying to be as physically ready as I possibly can and mentally, and therefore mentally fresh going into the majors. The only one I tend to not abide by that rule would be the PGA, US PGA, because obviously the WGC, Bridgestone event is the week before.
Yeah.
And it's kind of very similar, I must admit. Sometimes Bridgestone, which is played at the Firestone course in Akron, Ohio, is tougher than the PGA course.
Yeah, it can be brutal.
It can be brutal. You know, I've obviously won Houston, and it's a great event, and it's going on this week. It does a very good job of trying to prepare you for Augusta. Ultimately, nothing's like Augusta. You just can't. You can't replicate what you get in Augusta, Georgia. So, take the week off, charge the batteries. I've been traveling a lot. I've been on the road for 4 weeks. You know, a lot going on. Obviously, the victory in Tampa, which was great, but emotionally, there's highs and then there's sort of the crash afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So, this week, recharge, a lot of working out, a lot of ball striking, and then an infinite amount of putting and chipping. And things I do differently, I spent yesterday hitting a lot of just kind of ropey hook three woods for the tee shot on 10, for the tee shot on 13, maybe for the tee shot on 14, exactly what we talk about. Yep. I'll spend a lot of time chipping, trying to find areas to chip at the golf courses that I play around here in Arizona into the grain. So I work on quality of strike. I have been known, don't tell any greenkeepers, but I have been known to chip off green.
Yep.
To again work on the quality of strike, not taking a dinner, but working on ball first, nice clean contact, because chipping is so difficult around Augusta. They mow everything towards the player for reasons, obviously, to slow the golf ball down off the tee, to negate, kind of to eliminate driving distance as much as possible. It obviously makes the quality of strike very, very difficult for the iron shot off the fairway or the chips around the green. But also, it looks cool on TV. So when the camera's at the green looking back towards the tee, they've got that down grain, nice, yeah, shiny, light green view. And when you're on the tee looking towards the green, it's the other way around. It's kind of the dull into the grain. And it's actually really difficult to look at the fairway definition sometimes.
You are listening to the Talking Golf Podcast. To hear future episodes, remember to click subscribe in your favourite podcast directory. And if you're enjoying what you're hearing, please take the time to rate us. You can follow us on Instagram by searching Talking Golf Podcast or contact at Hugh Marr on Twitter.
So it's little tricks like that, finding slopey putts, working on speed. Is there anything else? I have put a rescue in the bag, I have to admit it. I put it in Tampa, so I've been working with the rescue the last couple of days. Again, I'll hit shot, the second shot on two is, and the second shot on 13 are possibly two of the most extreme side hill or downhill or combination side of downhill lies, or even 10's another one, that you'll ever face on a golf course. And so working on shots off uneven lies is another one, trying to get the strike down and get the trajectory correct to then hold the greens. So, I do a lot of stuff. The rest of the game just stays the same. Just go out there and hit it well and putt well and hit bunkers well. But
it's no different to playing an Open Championship, for example. You'd put extra attention into the skills you'd require at Carnoustie, for example, this year.
Correct.
In your week before.
You'd work in shots out of pot bunkers. You'd work on maybe a bullet two iron, like a driving iron. Wind play.
Yep.
You know, if it starts blowing, if it gets really, really windy here in Arizona, I'll go out there and I'll purposely practice in a left to right wind, an awful left to right wind, with the left wind off my left shoulder hard.
Yep.
And trying to work the ball back into it. Well, what happens if I cut it? How much will it move? Yeah, I'd do some knockdown six irons and five irons, pretending I'm hitting 150 yards into a 30-mile-an-hour game. Yeah, I'll do all that stuff.
So slightly left-field question. You said, I think it was 2000, was it 6 or 7 you won in Houston? Maybe a little later.
2009.
Okay, I'm definitely getting old. So 2009, you win in Houston, obviously first win PGA Tour. Did that mess up your chances of playing well at Augusta the next week?
Oh, I played horribly the following week. One of my worst performances. I've realised I'm really crap at parlaying a victory into playing well for the following week.
So developing momentum isn't something in the Casey game.
No, I'm really good at finishing kind of top fives in a row or top tens in a row. Last year, I had a couple of back-to-back runners-up in the FedEx Cup playoffs, or maybe it was the year before. I don't know. I'm fine at that kind of stuff. But for whatever reason, yeah, I'm clearly an emotional, bit of a pleb when it comes to turning one victory into another, which makes, I think, guys who can do that, I think it's
that's
amazing.
That's remarkable.
Because I've never been able to do that.
Remarkable. Just the standards that players can churn out week after week, some players can, is just astounds me.
Yeah. I think to say top fives or runners-up is not as big a deal. It's not as much of a drain. Win after win after win. Going back to Tiger, that's just amazing what he was constantly doing.
That's it.
It didn't matter.
So playing with Tiger, you've fortunately or unfortunately, probably a little bit of both, you basically spent your entire career competing against Tiger from the moment you set foot in Arizona to now. So you've seen him at his very, very best. You played collegiately against him and played, I think...
I didn't. I was a little bit... He's a little bit older than me. I just missed him collegiately. So when I turned up in Arizona State, which was January 1997, my very first month in town here as part of the golf team, part of Arizona State golf team, we did the radios for, I'll give you a quick story, we did the radios for ESPN at the Phoenix Open, So that all that entailed was calling in the order of play. Really difficult task, you know, kind of the play first. So you radio it back to whoever's in charge. They radio it to the TV camera guy, so he knows which player to go to first. Very, very simple. And I'm out there with a guy called Jason Housie, who's now working for TaylorMade on the PGA Tour building clubs. And we're running around, and we've got Tiger's group. And I, whatever day it was, I can't remember. But he's playing with Omar Urusti.
Yep.
So we're having a great time because we know the order of play is going to be, well, it's going to be Omar first and then Tiger because he's hitting it like 40 yards past him. So we're just wandering around watching this golf. It's fantastic. And we get to 16.
Yep.
And I stand on the left side of the tee, just right behind him. And Omar Urusti gets up first and he hits it to about 3 feet and the crowd goes bananas. Absolutely mental. Before the days of skyboxes on 16 at TPC Scottsdale. But there's probably more people back then. Like a good, don't want to exaggerate, but it's a good 10,000, seems like a good sort of 10,000 people around the hole. And then Tiger steps up and holds it. I was there for the hole in one. I've been there a month. I mean, the beer cans are flying. It's the loudest thing still to this day I've ever heard on the golf course. So I just missed him in college, but, you know, as soon as I got here, I got to see the Tiger mania and then obviously turned pro in 2000,
yep.
late 2000. And then that was it, playing with him kind of moved up the world rankings.
You seem to have been drawn with him quite a lot at Augusta, particularly.
Yeah, there was 1 year I played in the first three rounds.
Yeah, the year Zach won.
Was it the year Zach won? God, that was a cold year.
That was
the coldest year I've ever. It was awful. Yeah, what's the question then?
How good was he?
He's unbelievable. I don't have an issue saying that now. I think when you're young and you're trying to, or younger, you know, less mature, immature, you don't want to admit. You're like, no. I reckon if, you know, I play my best golf game, you know, what was the Poulter quote? When I play my best, it's just going to be me and Tiger. I love that one.
I wonder if he regrets that now.
No, he doesn't. It's Ian. It's great. I love Ian. We all say that in our minds. You want to believe that, but it's one of those things. I mean, I'll be honest. You see some of the stuff he did, and I hope he will continue to do. It's unbelievable. It's freaky. Not only does he have every shot I've ever seen, an ability to pull it off under pressure as well, he made stuff happen that was really kind of freaky. It sounds a bit bizarre, but he had such a will, a desire, a belief that things were going to happen, that they did. Balls would disappear into trees and they would fall out in the middle of the fairway. And it's almost, you know, almost creating what happened. You know, he's got the universe aligning and the belief, and it's like pure creation happening in front of you. And so it's the freakiest stuff. Brilliant.
And he fundamentally changed the game of golf.
Yeah, never seen anything like it. So having played with him in his prime, which I don't regret, not at all. My only regret is that I want current generation to see what he was doing to everybody on the golf course when he was playing his best. Because I think that the current generation is starting to see Tiger make his comeback, and they've seen some pretty good stuff. And we saw some comments not that long ago. I think it was some guys in like LA going, you know, the crowd's unbelievable. It must cost Tiger, you know, a shot around having to put up with this, you know, the hysteria and the crowds. And I'm thinking, mate, that's what it was like for 18 years or however long it was when he was in his prime. Yeah. I mean, every week, every day.
He hasn't had a shot in competitive golf without that environment, without that around him.
No, and so even more so, the ability, the crazy things that happened, but then under that kind of scrutiny. You don't know. You don't know what Nicklaus did in his prime and how it was, and you see footage of some of these greats. You see the way the fairways were lined when, you know, Hogan was playing, Snead was playing, Jones. Different. You can't. I can't tell you that, you know, the greatest that's ever been. But my goodness me.
Yeah, he's one of the top two.
He's a hero. I mean, he's cool. I don't mind saying that. And so when I beat him the other day, I'm so happy because it's like finally got one up on you.
After 20 years of trying.
And I've had some, 20 years of trying. I had some great moments, though. It was wonderful to play. You take the distractions and put them to the side because sometimes it was very difficult to play with him. The great thing is there has never been any gamesmanship with Tiger. He is a sportsman. He's a gentleman. Will he go out of his way to make it easy for you? No, not at all. But he's not going to do anything that crosses the line. There's no gamesmanship. Yeah. But he'd be fully aware that if he taps in his 2-foot putt, that all of a sudden the throng of 5,000 people following our group would just walk off to the next tee. I mean, he's fully aware of that,
yeah.
But he doesn't care. But there's been a couple of moments where, and one of them was at Augusta, where just funny things, let's say, because I have a good rapport with him on and off the golf course. I think it was about the third round one year at Augusta. And on number 12, he hits it in the water. Actually, I don't know, remember who teed off first, but he hit it in the water. He souped it on 12. And I almost hold my tee shot about 3 or 4 inches away from the hole. It was a front left pin position. And it was just one of those kind of moments where, as he's dropping the ball and trying to figure out the yardage with Stevie, I kind of yelled back to him, "Tiger, do you mind if I just finish this out for birdie?" And he gives me the stare. Kind of the FU stare. So tap in, I got a grin on my face. He hits him, and now he's got a really difficult shot. And he hits a glorious pitch to about 6 feet, holds it for a brilliant bogey, because it could all go horribly wrong at that moment. And kind of, you know, walks up the hill and gives it kind of an FU Casey kind of thing, and then sort of continues to play the back nine, the rest of the back nine, brilliantly, and beats me. But it's just, it's fun like that. You can have a bit of banter with him. You know, he likes a joke. He likes to have a laugh. And I'm glad I've been in that environment several times to experience it firsthand.
Yeah, well, I remember, I guess it was the same year that we were talking about, 2007. And I don't think I'd ever watched Tiger play. I'd watched him hit balls. And first round, he hit it everywhere. I mean everywhere. And it was cold as hell, bouncy as hell. And I think he knocked it around in something like 72 or 73, hitting it all over the place. And walking off afterwards thinking, that is the single best round of golf I'm ever going to see. Because he had no right to break 80. Yet he managed to find a way to work it. Just, he had the shots he needed to get out of trouble. And he was so good at managing where to play the course from when he got into trouble. Remarkable. I hope he hangs around for a whole lot longer. And I hope he wins again, because the game of golf is definitely richer because of him.
I think he will. I really do. What I saw in, not so much in LA, he obviously struggled there. But then, you know, but you can't judge a guy on, you know, kind of first week back. Honda was, you know, better. And Tampa, I mean, there was some really good stuff. I mean, nowhere near what he's capable of. And it's the thing, nowhere near what he's capable of. And, you know, guys
still
finishing
second.
So,
yeah. Against a good field.
It was a good field. So, no, I think he will win. I really do. And I want him to win.
Yeah.
Obviously, it'd be nice if it was a week where I'm not there. But
I think
he's so
broke
cool.
You broke a lot of hearts in Tampa by beating him, I think.
Well, Bernd Wiesberger came up to me, and the Austrian's quite funny. For anybody who doesn't know him, he's a funny guy. He came up to me on the putting green in Austin the other day, and he goes, "How does it feel to be the guy that shot Bambi?"
beautiful. So when
I don't regret it, but
no, well, it makes it more memorable for everyone. So when are you heading down to Augusta next week? Are you going down Monday, or are you going down over the weekend?
No, I go down Sunday. But I don't overdo it. In years past, I've played 9 holes, I think, on Monday, 9 on Tuesday, 9 on Wednesday. There's just no reason. Practice rounds now take longer and longer, unfortunately. Guys want to try and hit every single putt out there and every single shot.
Yeah.
But, go down. Taking the family down. We do the usual, rent a house, have a good experience. I'm not sure if I'm going to do par 3 yet. The par 3 is getting incredibly difficult to get a tee time early. And everybody wants to play early. And yeah, because I get there late, tee time sheet's already filled up. I mean, I usually register sort of mid-morning on a Monday, and the tee time sheet's completely full. So we'll see. I've got, I had Fitzpatrick and Tyrrell wanting to play the par 3. So I said if they get down there really early and they get a tee time, put my name down. And then I might take Lex out there.
Oh, awesome.
My little, Lex is 3.5, my little boy 3.5. So it'll be perfect wavelength for Tyrrell. The two of them can walk around and talk.
I'm not sure who that's harsh on, but
he's harsh on Tyrrell. I like Tyrrell. I mean, I played with him in the Eurasia Cup, but it was brilliant. I really like his golf game.
Oh, he's a hell of a player.
I love
his mentality. Love the way he's just all or nothing.
Oh, he's barking. I mean, it, you know, it's difficult because he's, you know, he doesn't necessarily come across great on TV.
He's at the end of the day, it's slightly frustrating watching him, because I mean, I've watched him since he was playing junior golf, and he's an absolute angel in comparison to the way he was then. But it's not his real personality. He's not as chippy and aggressive and angry as he appears to be in the golf course. And he can really, really play.
Yeah, he can. They're all six. So I may, yeah, maybe par three. But also, I've not played the par three for a long time because you don't want to win it.
Yeah, that is the curse.
And I figure, what better way to not have an ability to win it than if then just don't play? Then you're fine.
So you're stood on the ninth tee of the par three with Lex walking around with you, and you're six under and leading by two. What do you do?
I don't know. See, I'm torn. Part of me just goes, stick it in the water and walk off. The other part of me goes, why don't you try and hold it, shoot eight under, and be the first, and then go and win the tournament, be the first guy to win both and break the curse. So
punchy,
I don't know.
Casey, punchy.
Although Kostas, Peter Kostas, my coach, he threatened me. He said, don't you dare win it. Not sure what he could do. I guess change my grip. I'm not sure I believe in, well, I believe in a lot of things. I don't know about the curses. I quite like a curse in sports. So,
well, this is certainly one that has, it's not even got close to being broken yet, has it?
No.
Podrig?
No, it hasn't.
I'm trying to think, there was someone who got close a couple of years ago, but
it's a great event though. I do think it's awesome. I think everything about that week is so cool. It really is.
It's such a unique place. Everything about it is unique. And
it is, and it's you feel giddy. You feel like it's sort of a child when you're there, you know. And it gets a little bit of criticism, you know. It's a private, but ultimately yes, there are a lot of rules, manicured to within an inch of its life, but ultimately this is a private club.
They can do what they want.
They're entitled to do exactly what they want. Exactly.
And just
I think this drive chip and putt thing that they've got going with the kids, I think, is brilliant.
Amazing. Yep.
They don't have to do anything to try and expand golf and make it, you know, go above and beyond to do their bit to enhance the game of golf. And I don't like the phrase, but kind of grow the game. But they do. Being the way they are, enhances it. And people who don't watch golf watch the Masters.
Augusta and the Masters grows the game courtesy of its existence. People want to...
Correct.
The amount of people who don't play the game will watch Augusta because it's Augusta. It's that special.
Yep.
It's that unique. It's that different. And as golfers, I think we've seen a lot of comment from Rory and Justin Thomas over the course of the last few weeks about fan behaviour. One of the most fabulous things about Augusta is that the fans behave like golf fans. And I'm not much of a traditionalist, but when it comes to behaviour on the course from spectators, I'm a real traditionalist. Augusta gets it right.
They do. It's interesting seeing grown men slightly scared of doing anything wrong. I think it's...
Yeah. You get told off for sitting down, you get told off for walking too quickly. And it's not marshals that are telling you to do it, it's policemen. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Proper security guards.
Yeah, it's the only event that I said there's only two events where you feel like as a golfer, I mean, golf is, you know, okay, it's a niche sport. It's I love golf, I think it's cool, but most of the public out there, most people would say golf's not cool. But there's two events where I feel like a rock star playing golf. And, you know, yeah, we play in some big environments, you know, the Open Championship, US Players Championship, it's great, 17 mega. But the Masters and the Ryder Cup are the only two where you feel really special. I mean, it's something different. Now, the Ryder Cup's a whole nother kettle of fish because you're bricking yourself and it's a lot of pressure. And that's a whole different world, whole nother level. The Masters, you feel like a rock star. You stand on that first tee, everybody's watching you. You know, nobody's looking at their phones or chatting to their mates and drinking too much beer and being obnoxious.
Very true.
Focused on you.
Yeah.
Those people are there because of, you know, the golf course, the history, who's won it in the past, and the golfers. And it doesn't matter if it's a multiple, you know, one of the greats, like a Fred Couples, or it's a rookie, his very first time to the Masters. They have the respect. They'll give that player the respect and watch, and they know the shot, and they know it's a good shot or a bad shot, and they'll applaud. And yeah, it's really cool. You feel like a star when you're on that property as a player.
Yeah. What's your take on behavior at other PGA Tour events? Is that something that bothers you, or are you reasonably comfortable with it?
Yeah, it's tricky. Does it happen? Yes. It's very small incidents. It's such a minuscule percentage of the crowd. It's a fraction.
Yeah.
It's ultimately, I said the other day, we've created this a little bit ourselves. Golfers and the tours have created this ourselves. You look at something like the Ryder Cup. I mean, I might as well use Rory as an example. I read Rory's comments the other day, but I could say, Rory, your behavior at Hazeltine, you know, hyping people up, sort of igniting their atmosphere and crowd, which was brilliant golf, by the way, against Patrick Reed. It was phenomenal. It was so cool. Although we lost. You know, hang on, it's like pot kettle black. Hang on a second.
Yes.
You're doing one thing and saying another. So what is it? Does there need to probably be a little bit more security? Yes. Should people yell in before the player hits the ball? Not at all. Do I tolerate
absolutely.
It? No. Should they be kicked out for that? Yeah, probably. But there's a lot of raucous stuff going on. Alcohol's part of sports as a spectator. I mean, I don't know any sporting event that I go to where I don't drink.
apart from the ones you're playing in.
I think it's apart from the ones I'm playing in.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'd like to drink. But so I don't know. It's difficult. The thing is, I don't have a solution for it. So I haven't commented too much on it because I don't have a solution. A little bit of education, a little bit more security. That's kind of it. But I think our sports in this is, again, we've gone through waves of our sport is on the decline, numbers are dwindling, and yet we then, when we do have big crowds and it gets a little bit out of hand, we don't like it.
Yeah,
we
we're complain. Telling them off for behaving
well,
badly.
Which one is it? Because although I'm a traditionalist, and I, as you said, I love like going back to Augusta, what everything Augusta does and stands for. You know, it's a private club, they can do it. Green jackets, the rules. Even we can't be caught with, you know, mobile phones around and things like that. But I'm also one of those guys, if you and I decided to grab, you know, a golf club and go play street golf down the middle of St. Andrews late at night, you know, obviously not damaging any vehicles if we can help it, I'd call that golf. You know, top golf is golf.
Fabulous.
Fantasy
absolutely fabulous.
League is golf. Yeah, I love all that stuff because that's how I started. You know, back garden chipping into a bucket. That was golf.
Yep.
Just because it wasn't a golf course doesn't mean it wasn't.
Doesn't need to be 18-hole stroke play to be golf.
Not at all.
No, I'm a big believer in that, and I think it's in we've recorded a podcast with Martin Slumbers, who's had some very interesting comments on that, and it's fascinating to see that the RNA, who are sort of theoretically one of these very traditional, very staid organisations, they appear to be pretty much the leaders now in regenerating the game. Some great ideas out there.
Well, as they should. I mean,
I agree, 100%.
You know, you take the tours around the world, the European Tour, PGA Tour, and other tours. They can be the faces of the game. That's what people tune in and watch, and we have an obligation as players to do our best and portray the right image. But you can't expect the tours to come up with, and the European Tour's doing some cool stuff. I'll give Keith Pelley a lot of credit. He's come up with some cool stuff, sixes and the shot clock golf and stuff like that. But they shouldn't necessarily be the ones come up with these ideas.
No, I agree.
That should be a USGA and an RNA. So I applaud Slumbers for doing that and leading the way.
And I mean, it's interesting that the golf sixes thing, which I've had this debate with a few people, that was, outside of the majors, the best golf event I went to last year, because it was kids, families, no one wandering around with a 25-year-old Pringle sweater on. It was a sporting event. It wasn't a golf event.
And what's wrong with a geometric George sweater? Come on.
I had several in my time, all of which I've made a great effort to get rid of.
It does make me laugh, though. Other sports, rarely do the spectators dress up all the way. They might have an ounce of clothing that resembles the sport that they're witnessing. You might wear a football jersey to a football match. I think that's fair play, you know, fair play, for lack of a better term. But you don't go full kit, okay?
No.
I think there's even an Instagram and a Twitter hashtag for that.
With a glove hanging out your back pocket while you're watching golf.
Correct. It's fine to wear a golf shirt, wear a golf hat. But when people turn up in full golf get-up, even the shoes, I have a hard time with that. I mean, you wouldn't go to Formula One in a helmet, would you? You wouldn't go to wrestling dressed up in your wrestling shorts or something.
yet another thing that makes this wonderful sport unique. Maybe they all think they're going to get a tea time. Paul, thank you. We've taken more than enough of your time. Obviously, very best of luck next week. We'll all be pulling for you. Don't want to get in the way of your preparation, your practice anymore. I look forward to watching you progress next week and hopefully have a chat at some point soon.
My pleasure. Hugh, thank you very much, mate.
Stay well. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 1 of the Talking Golf podcast. This week's episode featured PGA Tour professional Paul Casey. It was hosted by European Tour coach Hugh Marr and produced by Matt Gore of Icon Business Media. Tune in to part 2 of our Masters Week special from Thursday the 5th of April, where Hugh talks to specialist putting coach Phil Kenyon.